ages. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy night, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Finner Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we're first going to conclude with the final half hour of the documentary we aired last week, Anatomy of a Sacrifice Zone, about how the people and the environment of the small rural town of Oxford in New Jersey are being poisoned by a waste incinerator that they didn't want, while the incinerator's operators import waste from outside the locality to maximize their profits, and government officials turn a blind eye. Then, a report on the inaugural protests from Washington, D.C.
The following is a special presentation of Coyote Nation Press.
Part 5, The Price. New Jersey has the highest breast cancer mortality rate of any state in the nation. Fact. Warren County has the highest breast cancer rates in New Jersey. Fact. The cancer rate for women in Oxford is nearly triple the county average. Bruce Schaefer is the administrative director of outpatient services at Hackettstown Community Hospital. He is a registered respiratory therapist and a board member and past president of the American Lung Association's Northern Regional Advisory Board. We asked him about respiratory illness in the county.
Some of the environmental issues I'm not as well versed in, but I do realize that they can pose dangers. And I don't know if any of the air quality has been measured to see that there's a dramatic increase of particulate matter in the air. But if there is, yeah, it could be a factor. In general, you're probably seeing some increase. Whether it's because of diagnostics, though, I'm not really sure, and that's something that probably has to be qualified. But I will say there's might be a higher incidence than there was. But I, like I said, I'm not sure if the doctors are diagnosing it better. If they were just saying, oh, he has bronchitis, or he has this, or he has a bad cold, a lot of times it seems like children are being diagnosed properly now. Adults, yeah, I do see, probably diagnostics is helping us a little there. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more. I just wonder sometimes how many people walked around and, you know, would wheeze and nobody ever said anything about it. I think there are some factors there. I would say if you probably talk to some of the school nurses, they would say that there seems to be a relatively high incidence of asthma, you know. That's what I've, speaking to some of the school nurses, I would say, yeah, they would say there was a higher incident.
Marianne Nyman is the school nurse at the Oxford Central School. We asked her about respiratory problems among the students.
I'm seeing a rise not only in the amount of children using an inhaler on a regular basis, but also the severity of their bronchial attacks, so that some of these students have required hospitalization. I also noticed that asthma appears to run in families. We have families that have more than one child using an inhaler. And I'm also earmarking potential children with asthma. They may be showing signs such as eczema this year, the younger students. And I'm earmarking them that perhaps in a year or two or three or five that they may be an asthmatic.
A student who was having trouble breathing interrupted our interview to get his asthma medication. Marianne Nyman described what happened.
We were interrupted right now because one of my students that's in an after-school basketball program, you're not playing basketball, it's field hockey, stick hockey, needed to use an inhaler, and he's currently using Ventolin. And he uses that. How many times do you wait? I'm not going to mention your name.
As needed.
He was short of breath, and he was wheezing slightly, and he needed to use his inhaler. Now, what he's done is he's used his inhaler. He's waited a minute, took a second puff, used it again, and he knows enough to wait along the sidelines for another minute or two until he feels that he can participate within the sport. And then this is an independent decision. The physical education coach, as you noted, sent him over to me.
Lead, asbestos, any of those materials, and any unknown particulate is always a potential for a condition such as cancer or asthma.
Nationwide, asthma is the leading cause of absenteeism among school children. We were told by the Warren County Health Department and the Office of the Warren County Superintendent of Schools that no central records are kept on asthma-related school absences. Tumor Registry at Warren Hospital in Phillipsburg reported a 20.6% increase in Warren County cancers treated or diagnosed at that facility between 1994 and 1995. Fact. In 1994, Hackettstown Community Hospital reported colorectal cancer rates for men at 31.7% higher than the national average, and breast cancer rates at 32.3% higher than the national average. No comparisons were published for 1995. Fact. In 1995, Warren Hospital reported higher rates than the national averages for breast and lung cancer in women and for prostate and colorectal cancers in men. In addition to contaminated streams, toxic ash and leaking landfills, air emissions from municipal waste incinerators are considered by the United States government to be extremely dangerous. Dioxin is a highly toxic byproduct produced in the manufacture of some pesticides and in the routine operation of incinerators, smelters, and paper mills. It is a deadly microscopic compound now thought to be responsible for hormone, reproductive, and immune deficiency problems in wildlife and humans. What makes dioxin especially dangerous is its potential for damage even at minuscule doses. The United States Environmental Protection Agency has said municipal solid waste incinerators, like the one in Oxford, are among the top producers of dioxin. Internationally noted scientist Dr. Barry Commoner has said dioxin is the most perilous chemical threat to the health and biological integrity of human beings and the environment. Dr. Paul Connett is director of Work on Waste USA and a professor of chemistry at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. He is an internationally recognized authority on waste issues. He spoke recently during a community meeting in northwest New Jersey.
We poison ourselves with leachate from landfills, and we poison ourselves with the air emissions from incinerators and then the ash from incinerators. So that's the first jolt. Unfortunately, that jolt only, you only slap the people of the whole of New Jersey, you slap the people in Ironbound, you slap the people in Rahway, you slap the people in Oxford, and who the hell cares about them? You know, they're just tiny little rural communities somewhere. We don't care about them. So you're not slapping everybody. Well, at least they don't realize that until they start hearing about environmental hormones and the cancer rates of certain testicular cancer has tripled since 1940, prostate cancer has doubled since 1973, breast cancer, etc., gone from 1 in 16 to 1 in 8. The increasing number of children, male children being born with undescended testes and all these kind of things, which more and more scientists, Theo Coburn in particular, wrote Our Stolen Future, are relating to environmental hormones, these endocrine disruptors, these man-made chemicals which disrupt hormonal signals. Ah! Okay. I have just disrupted a hormonal system. That scream went into your ear, sent a signal to your brain sent a signal to your bloodstream, sent a signal to the adrenal glands to put adrenaline into your bloodstream to circulate the body, go to your muscle tissues, start and give a signal to break down the sugar faster in your muscle tissues so that if you had to get out of this room fast because I've gone crazy, overwork, it was just overwork, then you could have got out of the door. And what we have, so in other words, a lot of our chemistry in our bodies is regulated by hormones. There are two kinds of hormones. There are hormones like adrenaline, which have a receptor on the outside of the cell, and they essentially adjust the activity of enzymes, make them faster or slower, like breaking down sugar faster or slower. But there are other more fundamental hormones, which are fat-soluble, which get into cross the membrane of the cell, react with a receptor inside the cell, and what does that do? It switches on and off genes. And so we have the same amount of DNA, genetic material, in every cell of our body, but why are they different? The answer is because different genes have been switched on. And when is this absolutely and critically important, that when we're switching things on and off? Answer: during fetal development and the development of the infant. That's when you are controlling with these chemical messengers. And the whole notion that we have these chemical messengers, man-made ones, man-made chemicals, which are copying these signals, which function at enormously low concentrations, incidentally. The hormones in our bloodstream function at parts per million to parts per billion, trillion levels. Very, very low. So if you start producing chemicals that mimic those things, they're going to be terribly potent. Like dioxin is described as the most potent dysregulator of human chemistry that we've ever studied. And the problem with these things is that these substances that we've picked out for special attention, PCBs, dioxins, furans, DDT, other organochlorine pesticides, what do they have in common? They're all fat soluble. Okay, that means the first line of defense is not there because they can get straight into the tissues, across the membrane. And secondly, they're highly persistent, which means that they defeated, when you hear about a chemical being persistent, it means that it has defeated the number one detoxification mechanism of the body. The number one detoxification method in our body, which deals with most of our pollutants and our drugs, is called cytochrome P450. It's part of a collection of enzymes whose main function is to convert fat-soluble substances into water-soluble substances. It's the first part of that process. When you've made the substance water-soluble, you can get it out of your kidneys. Now, it might damage you in the way. I mean, there are certain things which you can do that to, but they're so toxic that by the time you've excreted them, you've already done some damage. But in this case, we don't get past square one. The half-life of dioxin in our tissues is 7 years. So if you get some dioxin in your tissues today, it'll be 7 years before it's gone down to half of that level, another 7 years before it's gone down to a quarter, another 7 years before it's gone down to an eighth. Now, here is the absolute dynamite of this whole issue. These things build up in our fatty tissues, right? The dioxins, the furans, the PCBs, the DDTs, etc. A woman has a way of getting rid of those fat-soluble substances that a man doesn't have. It's called having a baby. When you have a baby, those fat-soluble toxins which have been stored in your body are going to be delivered to the fetus. And so our fetuses now have to grow in an environment where chemicals can be sending the wrong signals. And the most obvious place where this is happening is in sexual development, which is controlled by hormones. I didn't know this. I'm not a biologist, but I didn't know this until a couple of years ago. A mammal has got the physical apparatus to become either a male or a female sexually. That sexual development is controlled by hormonal levels. It's controlled by the levels of estrogen and testosterone. And if you get the wrong signals, a creature that was designed to become a male will become a female, or halfway in between, you won't know. We can see this very clearly in wildlife. That's where Theo Coburn began, but we're also getting some evidence that this is happening to human beings too, which is extremely disturbing. If you add to that, back in June of last year, June of 1996, a word that many people have used, and rightly so, people have talked about synergism. They said, it's all very well for you when you do these health risk assessments, you look at each pollutant one at a time, and you can't look at them all because you don't know what all of them are, number one, and number two, you don't have toxicological data on all of them, but you do your best shot, you look at all the ones that you know, all the ones you have toxicological data on, you add up what you think is going to be the effect on the human body and make your calculations. And then people say, well, wait a moment, what if two chemicals together produce a greater effect than each separately added together? Not additive, but multiplicative. Multiply them together. That's called synergism. And the opposite to that is called antagonism, where they counteract each other. Well, there was an experiment reported in Science magazine in June of 96, which showed that two environmental hormones, two of these endocrine disrupting chemicals, which together seemed not very potent, separately they weren't very potent, but when they were mixed together, the potency increased by a factor of 1,000. Incineration is a sophisticated answer to the wrong question. We're getting more and more sophisticated at addressing the wrong question. Our task is not to become better at destroying finite resources. Our task is, as a society, to learn better how to handle finite resources so they don't have to be destroyed, so they can go round like nature, round and round and round and round. And so whilst we have corrupt people, I have two laws on pollution. The more corrupt your state, the more corrupt your community, the more polluted your community is going to be. That's the bad law. The good law says the level of pollution decreases as the level of public participation increases. The more that we are involved, the less likely that we are going to be polluted. These are critical. One of the brilliant things that they had is these people with their minuscule sense of value and vision had that plotted this incinerator, and plotting is probably the right word, was to say, well, we can't build them in cities. There's so many people in cities, they complain, so let's put them in the rural areas. Much safer in the rural areas. Remember that? I remember when we defeated the incinerator in Philadelphia, then the next tendency was to put it out in, you know, Lancaster County, biggest milk-producing county in the whole of New York, the whole of the United States. I could go into details on that, I won't. We couldn't get Hershey chocolate concerned about that. They're in Lancaster County. Okay. But in just last year, 95, a guy called Michael McLaughlin, who is a researcher at Bayreuth University, he's a Canadian, but he's researching in Bayreuth, gave a paper in which he estimated how much dioxin a cow consumed in one day. And he estimated that in one day, a free-grazing cow would put into its body the dioxin which had been in 100,000 cubic meters of air. And you work out how much grass the cow is consuming and how much air is falling, how much particles from the air is falling on that grass. It's 100,000 cubic meters in one day. Well, I did a little calculation. A human being breathes about 20 cubic meters a day. If you divide 20 into 100,000, it comes to 5,000. So we would have to breathe the air next to the cow for 5,000 days or 14 years to get the same amount of dioxin that the cow puts into its body. 14 years worth of breathing. So when people built these incinerators in rural areas, it was destined, it was inevitable that more people would be exposed to dioxin through the milk, the butter, the cheese, the ice cream, and everything else that's made from this milk near the incinerator. The cow is not only a magnificent collector of dioxin, it's also a protector of dioxin, because once it's in its body, it's not being broken down by environmental mechanisms like photovoltaics or other rather slow process as it happens, but in the body of the animal that's protected. And then, of course, it's a magnificent deliverer of dioxin. Magnificent. So well over 90% of the dioxin that we are getting is from the food chains. And so the whole notion of building this incinerator in Warren County right next to farms in a rural area was utterly preposterous. And we said that. It's not as if we didn't say that. I mean, I presented a paper in Japan in 1986 at the International Symposium in Japan, in which we did these calculations, not McLaughlin's calculations, but similar ones, where we said 1 quart of cow's milk is equivalent to 8 months of breathing. Don't build these in rural areas. It's also made me aware that, as I've indicated, the stakes are very, very high here. This isn't just trash that we're talking about. We're talking about two different ways of looking at the planet. Do you see the planet as something to be consumed by a human species, and it probably takes 100 years to consume it all? Or do we see us as a species that's got to learn, however painful it is, to live in harmony with all the other creatures? Those two different visions of the planet. And I started earlier to talk about pragmatism. I mentioned the one pragmatism at the price that we pay for this is we get poisoned if we take the easy options, or so-called easy options, the quick fixes. But there's another pragmatism. And that is, by virtue of my traveling around, I have seen what it's like to be in a developing country and seeing our lifestyle beamed out on these TV programs and in these commercials. I've seen it in India, I've seen it in Bangladesh, I've seen it in South America, Central America, Eastern Europe. There's not a place on the surface of this planet that is not eyeing our lifestyle, drooling over this lifestyle. They want it too. And I just imagine what it would be like if China, with 1.3 billion people, was consuming, living the lifestyle which everybody in New Jersey and elsewhere takes for granted. They take it as a norm. If you try to take this lifestyle away from us, there would be a riot. And yet, if 1.3 billion Chinese were able tomorrow to grab that same lifestyle and live it, we would feel it. And plus a billion Indians, plus X number of South American, Central American, Eastern Europeans, they want it. And so I feel an incredible urgency to get us to send out better signals, to get our young people in particular who are going through colleges and universities to have a different attitude to what life is about, not earning as much money as you possibly can in order to spend it on everything that you possibly can, not to live it in an isolated little cubicle with a giant bloody television set where you sit on the couch and die as the superstars live on the other side of the plastic screen. And the only way that you can cross that plastic screen is to buy what they are advertising every 7 minutes on that screen, to fulfill all the emptiness that you feel living life on a couch instead of out in the community and living with people. The philosophy that we are now seducing the planet is this. This is our 20th century philosophy. The more you consume, the happier you will be. Now, should there be anybody here that knows any of these people, that represents the PCFA and other pseudo-governmental agencies, which are governmental when they want to be governmental and private when they want to be private? If you have, after this experience, after generating this enormous debt, what is it, $90 million debt, if after this, and after all we know about the dangers of that ash and the dangers of the emissions from this plant, if you have the temerity, if you have the confidence to go ahead and to expand this facility and ask for more waste, for more places, and continue to treat your community, your neighbors, as a patsy community for every slob that is not prepared to put on a decent reuse, a recycling and composting program, that you're prepared to operate as a toilet for other people's laziness. If you have the confidence to do that, then the only thing I ask you is to have the confidence to debate me in a public debate.
The real price of a short-sighted waste management plan cannot be discussed in terms of bonds or interest rates, taxes, or dollars. The real price of squandering resources cannot be measured in parts per million. The true cost is the effect on our health and the health of the communities, like Oxford, that bear the brunt of our excesses. A legacy of cancer, asthma, immune deficiencies, and reproductive disorders we leave to our children and their children is, in the end, the only cost that matters.
This man had colon cancer. He had a colostomy done, lost the kidney. 2 years later, he died of bone cancer. The lady that lived in this house here, she developed cancer of the throat and in the lungs.
Oxford, New Jersey, Anatomy of a Sacrifice Zone, was written and produced by Bill McLaughlin. Our program was produced at the studios of WNTI in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Digital editing was provided courtesy of LifeSpeed Productions. Original music was composed and performed by Brian Carroll. Our narrator was Mark Goldberg. Funding was provided in part by a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism. If you missed any part of this program or would like to hear the complete five-part series, an audio archive can be found at our website at coyotenation.org. This has been a special presentation of Coyote Nation Press, which is solely responsible for its content. I'm June Benes. Thank you for listening.
For the remainder of the program, we're going to provide some coverage of the Inauguration Day protests in Washington, D.C., from the bottom up. Tens of thousands of people, with crowd estimates ranging from 20 to 50,000, converged on the nation's capital to express their displeasure at the inauguration of G.W. Bush, the stolen election, and the Republican corporate-driven agenda. Citizens in towns large and small held local demonstrations to protest the inauguration as well. Because Unwelcome Guests is pre-taped, we were unable to bring you this material in last week's show. The material is still very relevant, because though the pundits have been pontificating about healing and unity, a whole lot of people on the streets of D.C. had other priorities: justice, democracy, and an end to corporate control of government and society. There were very few arrests, less than 24, according to the reports. Rather, the police strategy seemed designed to prevent protesters from reaching the inauguration route, and the media strategy seemed designed to minimize the protests in the public eye. The protesters on the streets, as you will hear, were of all ages and races and came from all over the country. Their political outlooks ranged from outraged voters at their very first protest to radical activists with a clear position of opposition to capitalism and the state. The Independent Media Center, the IMC, had hundreds of volunteer reporters in the streets and also put on a day-long net radio cast that was rebroadcast on a number of radio stations here as well as abroad. It focused on the protests and the issues behind them. The material in tonight's show was taken from the IMC radio reports. We especially want to acknowledge one of our own, Gretchen, host of the Citizen X report on Syracuse Community Radio, who was one of the people who made the outstanding IMC broadcast happen. To give you a flavor of Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day, first some voices from the streets.
Tell me your name and where you're from and the group you're with.
My name is Injera Shakur. I'm here from Houston, Texas. I'm a member of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement.
And you came here with a group from Texas?
We came on a bus from Houston, yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about, elaborate a little bit about why you're here at this event today?
So these guys,
Where is outraged is the rest of the country about the blatancy, the arrogance with which the votes of the people, the voice of the people, has been disregarded. What happened is clear, but the arrogance to go forth, the programs are such that they don't care what we know. And in Texas, hundreds of human beings have been slaughtered under the death machine of under George Bush's regime. We're here to strengthen our fight. We will struggle against this machine.
I am Jen Schmidt. I'm from Washington, D.C. We're joined by citizens from as far away as Southern California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and then also here in Washington, D.C. We are the Arctic Avengers, and we are here united in our opposition to Bush's misguided policy to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the oil industry dream team he's assembled to lead his administration.
Can you speak a little bit about the street theater that you have going on here?
The street theater was a collaborative effort of all these people working together to get the word out to the public, but most importantly to the new administration and to the American Congress, that this is an issue that the people care very deeply about. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is one of the last great wilderness treasures on this planet, and we feel very strongly that it should be protected. We hope that in the next year, the U.S. Congress will take action to protect this area as wilderness.
Actually, we're the corporate force for increased plutocracy, and we represent a number of corporate interests who are very pleased on today, including Bush supporters who are very glad to have oil interests, timber interests, and everyone else, because we were really worried that Bush wouldn't be able to make his own decisions. So we're glad that his major campaign contributors are present with him today, are present with him in his cabinet. We're really excited today.
White domination, white racism, poverty, discrimination, slavery, suffering, and death.
Can I just ask you your name?
My name is Marie Thornton.
And where are you from?
I'm from Detroit, Michigan.
You came all the way from Detroit to be here today?
All the way because our right to vote seemed to have been taken away in this election.
How many hours were you on the bus to come here to this beautiful weather in Washington, D.C.?
Approximately 11 hours after getting off from work and working all day, I felt I had an obligation to come here as an African-American and just as a citizen of the United States, and tell them I feel that we were disenfranchised in the last election.
What message do you want George Bush to take from the presence of so many people here, not expressing, by no means expressing support for his swearing-in ceremonies?
Well, one thing he needs to understand that we're not going to agonize that he's the president. We're going to organize, and we're going to hold him accountable because he stole our right way to vote, and we going to organize against him and basically hold him accountable since he decided to, bushwhack or ambush the presidency.
And I love your sign. Don't agonize, let's organize.
That's
a great
correct.
Sign you're holding there.
Right.
And what's the mood in the community back home in Detroit? Are people sort of in a state of mind that you think they will get active and not just, stay apathetic as
well,
has happened very often?
I think in the last election, the state of Michigan voted overwhelmingly for Gore to be our president. So we, on November the 7th or 8th, or the election day, we were active, and we will continue to be active, and we will continue to hold him accountable to the people that is in the state of Michigan as well as in Detroit.
Just the last question. There are so many people here with a whole variety of different interests and agendas who are, expressing opposition to this new administration. Do you see sort of new coalitions and new energy coming into progressive movement?
Yes, young people. As a community activist in the city of Detroit, I see more young people in Detroit. I was impressed that a lot of young people decided to get politically involved, because it's our 18 to 35-year-olds that need to get out here and vote, you know, because we'll be gone. I'm 50, and they need to continue our rights to vote and uphold it, because we just can't let anybody snatch it away from us like Bush did.
This is the first time in my life I've ever demonstrated. I stood up, I just stood up in my living room and kept yelling at the television set, and finally just realized, I said to my mother, who's standing over there, she's an artist, she came with her husband. My mother's 64 years old with a walking problem and came out here with us. And I just realized after standing up in front of the television and yelling that that was a pretty useless thing and no one was hearing me, and I was just joining a part of a homogenized America that never stood up and said what it thought. And I have just been sufficiently outraged, and that's the reason I'm standing out here. You know, I don't understand why five people chose the president of the United States of America. And I think how sad that half of the country is willing to be delighted by the fact that five people chose because it advanced their beliefs rather than advancing democracy through a fair election. And that's the reason we're out here. Okay.
And your name is?
My name is Tony Christopher, and I'm 47 years old.
Where are you from?
I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana.
And you came up here on a bus or without
the
bus?
No, I drove with my mother and her husband, and we drove 15 hours straight through.
I want to look Bush in the eye and let him know he will never represent me.
It seems the way the police controlled this demonstration, seeing as they couldn't really confine it because they had to leave all these routes open for people moving around the city and for celebrating types, they used a certain kind of a scare tactic. It's like, we'll back you against the wall, pick a few people out, and let everybody else go. But it's kind of like, we can do this to you. You know, look, we're gonna wave our batons in your face, and we're gonna make you really, really afraid. You're gonna feel your adrenaline. It's sort of like grabbing you by the shirt collar and jacking you up against the wall and putting you down.
Inauguration of my life. I'm coming because I want to help save the world.
And they were booing and mainly giving the finger to the passing president and his entourage. And I mention that only because CNN, apparently, from what I've heard, has said that they didn't see much protesting going on.
Bush drove by with an upside-down American flag right by him. The cops did not do a thing.
That is so wonderful.
It was an autonomous zone. Basically, what we saw was a spontaneous autonomous zone happen. The police bailed. The police realized they couldn't keep the space, and we ended up having it. It was incredible.
And now in Bush versus Gore, the Supreme Court has delegitimized the court system itself by stopping the vote counting in Florida and selecting the president. The courts of public opinion controlled by the corporations, sometimes called the media, may not notice it. But let's say it to each other. When Mr. Bush is sworn in by the Chief Justice, who abused his power to elect him, the government itself is being seized. The only basis for democratic legitimacy is the consent of the governed. That was the deal. The presidency has been seized. The government has been seized. The covenant is broken. Mr. Bush is not the president. He is the special master appointed by the Supreme Court. After the secret four-month constitutional convention in Philadelphia, a matron of the city asked Benjamin Franklin, "Well, what have you produced in all this secrecy?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." Well, we have not kept it. It has been seized. We have lost the republic into a corporate oligarchy. And free Americans do not accept, and we do resist, a court-appointed master as our president. This is no longer a respectable government. We move on now, civilly, nonviolently, and with determination, to replace the American Republic, which is being taken from us at noon today, with a new American democracy. For this non-ideological, nonviolent rebellion to work, nothing is more necessary than closure and alliance between white Americans and the maximum victims of the American Republic, the blacks, whom we enslaved and still cruelly oppress.
The media and everyone for several weeks is that all of these security measures that the police have taken under the excuse of protecting the president, maintaining order and all that, they're not really concerned about a terrorist attack or somebody trying to assassinate Bush. They just don't want anti-Bush demonstrators anywhere near Pennsylvania Avenue. They want it to seem like everybody on Pennsylvania Avenue is just some idiotic fan of Bush. Yeah, it's okay. We got some racist executioner as the president, and he stole the elections by suppressing black voters in Florida. But that's okay. And we're here just to cheer him on. That's the scene that they want. Seen across the country and across the world. They don't want anybody who's got a sign that says, "Bush, free Mamiya," or "Bush equals president death and the racist death penalty," or "Hail to the thief," or "Defend a woman's right to choose," or "Bush equals racism." I'm just reading the banners and the practice that people have. They don't want anybody with a big, black, beautiful sign that just says, "No!"
Sounds from the streets of Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day. The sounds of protest. Nowhere were the voices of dissent more systematically excluded than at the inauguration ceremony itself. This event was big money only. Regular voters, even those who voted for G.W. Bush, were not on the guest list. Attendance was restricted to very large campaign contributors, and no dissent was allowed. We're going to hear next from Joan Roney, a young protester who managed to get in and had to take off her clothes to get her message across.
We're speaking now with Joan Roney, who's an oath of office protester, as you like to describe yourself. There have been a lot of creative protests out there. We saw only a glimpse of them on the mainstream media. So what happened?
Well, last night when I arrived into D.C., I was over at the Welcome Center, and some unknown person brought over a really nice-sized envelope that was inside with a beautifully laid-out invitation that had one large photograph of George W. Bush and one large photograph of Cheney, and the whole invite telling like what was going to happen at the inauguration ceremony and inviting me to come to it, and there was two tickets in there, so I figured that something creative should happen. So I looked for somebody who would go with me. I found a guy who I just met, and we were trying to brainstorm over what we would do. And we noticed on the invite that you couldn't bring, like on the little tickets it said you couldn't bring placards, which meant so we couldn't put stickers all over our clothes. We couldn't bring any signs. And the person who gave us the tickets said they didn't want to tell us who they were, so I have no idea who this person was. So basically we wrote on our bodies with a permanent ink. I wrote "No Democracy" with a question mark on my front or chest area, and on the back it said "Hail to the Thief." And on my right arm it said "One Person, One Vote," and on my left arm it said "Ricky, how could you? Ricky Martin, how could you?" So, and then my friend, Matthew Power, wrote no mandate on his front and no more prisons on his back. So basically we waited, we were nervous, we were in section 11 in the front, which is maybe about 20 yards back from the stage, right by a press stage. And we had decided we would wait until George W. Bush came out and was being sworn in to drop our drawers, basically, and walk. And so that's what he did. And it was kind of awful sitting there and having to pretend you're a Republican. The woman to my right said that she was friends with the Bushes and that they had given $50,000 to the campaign, and that's how they got their tickets. They asked us how we got, you know, they said, oh, so you must be pretty hooked in, basically. How did you guys get here? And we said we were press because they were surprised how young we were, I guess, so, and how motley we kind of looked, but...
And you didn't have all the expensive jewelry and clothing that they had there in the crowd.
There was more dyed blonde hair, like ashen blonde hair, that I've ever seen, and more mink coats that I've ever seen, and more Southern drawls. No offense to Southern drawls, but it was just amazing the amount of people like that. And, like, people were saying crazy things, like this lady to my right was saying when Jimmy Carter came out, she said, oh, well, he tries to be a nice person even though he's a Democrat. Like, that's what she said. And then the woman to my left, who was from Tennessee, she's like, well, Tipper Gore, I guess, is okay. And she's like, but, you know, we need more taxes, or less taxes for the rich. And the richer you are, the less taxes there are, so that there are more incentives and so that we don't have freeloaders in society. And that's what she was saying. She had a huge fur coat on, and I had to keep my mouth shut the whole time. I heard more people saying we need to bring back integrity, you know, and it was just mm-hmm. It was just crazy. There was a woman who was like, how did you get that seat? You know, we're in standing room only. And we donated $15,000 when we had, like, seats, and they had standing room only. So it was kind of crazy. It was really a crazy scene.
It really was an inaugural auction, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The people with the more expensive
yes.
donations to the RNC got the better seats. So it comes time to swear George Bush into office, and you're in the actual ceremonial area. And what happens?
Well, we're very scared at this point because... Basically, yeah, everyone surrounding us, you know, had tons of furs, ashen blonde, dried hair, you know, it was just very scary scene and very Republican. Some booed when Hillary Clinton came out. People did not hardly clap when Carter came out. Nobody clapped when Clinton came out or Gore. And so the surrounding area was just very nerve-wracking. And I was more afraid of the people who came for Bush, which was everyone surrounding us, than I was of the police and the Secret Service. But our plan was to, when Rehnquist came out to swear in Bush, that we would then drop our clothes. And that's basically what happened. I had already taken my coat off, put it over my arm, and Matthew took his coat off and put it over his arm. We held hands, you know, and then just took the rest of our clothes off, dropped part of our pants, and proceeded to walk diagonally down an aisle.
And what was the reaction of the crowd? I mean, how do these people, the Bushites, the Bush League, how did they respond?
Which is basically everyone, because there were no demonstrators. We were the only demonstrators, and we were supposedly Republicans to these people that I was sitting with. But the lady who was talking to us the whole time, the one from Tennessee, who was saying how much she disliked Gore and Clinton and how she was so happy with integrity coming back to the office, she her mouth dropped so wide open. She's like, you know, like totally freaked out. And then other people started yelling as they were taking pictures. I hope you get pneumonia. You know, I hope you freeze to death. Go back to Arkansas. People were, like, yelling and booing. And this was during him swearing, him saying, you know, I will uphold the, you know, America and the law, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what he was saying, but he's being sworn in, and there's, like, crowds, hundreds of people around us because everyone's supposed to have been sitting. So everyone's sitting down. We're standing, walking in the open aisle. We walk up to on a stage that overlooks the swearing-in stage or the state capitol. We walk up onto that stage and turn back to the audience or everyone in the facing Capitol Hill and basically show off our bodies. And that's when the Secret Service reached us and the police and started asking us to put our clothes back on.
So that's how the officials responded. They just asked you. They didn't grab you right away.
No, they didn't want to. I mean, the way this things works, I mean, you're in front of everybody, and I'm sure they didn't want to create a scuffle, because then mainstream cameras would have turned on, more mainstream cameras would have turned towards us. And now that I look back, maybe I should have created a scuffle. I'm not quite sure. But, you know, I listened to them, and I was like, well, just a moment. Let me just go to the next stage. So I walked down this one stage, went up another stage, and showed myself off to the audience. And that's when they started, like, kind of being a little more aggressive with putting the coat on me. And they told us to walk with them, that we were under arrest. But then they didn't arrest us. They detained us basically for an hour and a half and asked us lots of questions, that if we had any animosity to George W. Bush, if we wanted to bring any harm to him or assassinate him and things like that, and why I was here and if I've done this before. And, you know, and then they told me to take my clothes off again, and they took pictures of all the paraphernalia that I had on all over my body. So, yeah, that's what they did. It was funny. They got my name. They checked everything. But
Joan Roney. Yeah. Joan, do you think this is going to usher in a new era of streaking? I remember the 70s. There was a lot of streaking, late 60s, early 70s. You think you're going to bring back that, you know, that is a fashion in activism?
Well, I think any place where you're not allowed to bring a sign, placard, or sticker, I solemnly support anybody to streak right on their bodies. Probably would not have written on my body if I was allowed to have brought in signs or maybe put stickers all over my body, but they did not want any signs in there. When I first walked in there, and we were having second thoughts about doing this because we were frightened, like, what could Secret Service do to us? Could they think we were going to assassinate him? Like, we didn't know what they would do. But when you feel the oppressed emptiness or the feeling when you walked into that space of all these people that were like this, like, it was so depressing. I thought, like, I would have cried if I didn't do something. So I had to do something, and it better be peaceful and be naked with writing on my body and flowers in my hair, though I didn't have any, but...
Are you planning to crash the inaugural balls? You know, follow the fur, so to speak?
If somebody gives me any tickets, I'll definitely go to the inaugural ball. Anyone want to come with me? In fact, the Secret Service asked me that exact question, if I was planning on crashing any inaugural balls, and could I tell them which ones? I would personally like to know if, for some reason, that Republican person who's listening who gave me those tickets, you know, I would like to meet them, thank them, find out about them. Or if anyone has any video footage of the event.
And we have a public service message here. If you are a government employee and you want to become a leaker during the next 4 years, you can look at GAP.org. The Government Accountability Project specializes in helping whistleblowers. Call them up. Get their help. We know there's a lot of you out there who are career service employees of the government who really don't want to serve under the Bush League. There's many people who can help you. Send anonymous packages to your favorite nonprofit activist group, and they'll help you from the outside.
That was Joan Roney speaking with an IMC reporter. And what about those inaugural balls? In this next interview with In These Times journalist Jason Vess, we'll hear how they're all about buying access to power.
This is Che Maraschino. I'm sitting here with Jason Vess, investigative journalist from In These Times. First, speaking of Bush's balls, I'll read you a little excerpt from the Washington Post today. Tonight, 35,000 people will pack into 8 official balls. The high point of each will be the brief but thrilling sight of the new president and the first lady as they wave and do the ceremonial shuffle across the stage. Each visit will last about 10 minutes.
The rest of Rebler's time will be spent checking coats, standing in lines for the bar, standing in line for the restrooms, being packed in front of the stage, waiting for the president to show up, roaming for some place to sit, shouting over the music, deciding how soon to leave, standing in line to retrieve coats, and deciding whom to strangle the next morning. Well, Jason, that sounds like a lot of fun to me. What do you know about these balls? Who's behind all this?
Well, I mean, what's interesting about what you just read is not what's there, but what's not there. Namely, the balls, the whole inaugural celebration is really just another opportunity for big corporations to literally get their 2 cents in the service of getting access. Any number of corporations have ponied up hundreds of thousands of dollars to underwrite the celebration, and that money is giving them access to the new people in power who they're going to do everything they can to try to influence.
Such as? Let's name names here.
Well, there's something I thought was really interesting on the list of inaugural underwriters. One was Barbara Grimm, who gave $100,000. She's with Grimway Farms in California, which is one of the largest growers of carrots.
Corporate carrots.
And they also use quite a bit of a potentially carcinogenic chemical called methimsodium, which can build up into toxic gas underground and blow things up and has actually forced communities to be evacuated in the past.
So that's how we get corporate carrot bits, huh?
I would suspect that the $100,000 contribution to the inaugural celebration from Barbara Grimm will not go unnoticed by Christy Todd Whitman, will not be unnoticed by Ann Veneman. People who would have oversight of what she's doing in private life. So, you know, during the campaign, you know, everyone gives money to both parties. Yet, what they are buying is access. People aren't always successful in getting what they want in exchange for money, but they're at least getting a foot in the door or making sure they're at the head of the class or the head of the line. Another interesting thing, you know, this opportunity to build up good relations with the new administration. A number from sports, Major League Baseball gave $100,000. Pete O'Malley, who owns the LA Dodgers, gave $100,000. Baseball enjoys a unique position in terms of regulation, and I think they're going to do everything they can to make sure they can.
Not to mention the fact that they subsidized W's fortune. He made his fortune right off
exactly.
The Texas Rangers.
Exactly.
Through a public underwriting of a stadium that was handed over to the Rangers, and then he made magically $15 million out of $200,000 or something.
Right. And another, there's another perennial campaign finance veteran working with these inaugural balls to the tune of another $100,000, and that's Archer Daniels Midland.
Oh, ADM, supermarkets of the world. Yeah, they were always one of the biggest funders of the Republicans, and until they recently were nailed by the Justice Department for price-fixing the world's lysine market.
Exactly.
One of the few cases where they actually nailed top executives. Of course, they didn't go after Dwayne Andreas Sr., even though if you read this book, Rats in the Grain, which is a description by an attorney who followed the case, the Justice Department somehow overlooked the fact that there was a document shredder in Dwayne Andreas' office while they were raiding the offices of all these other executives. They failed to notice that there were documents stacked in the corner of Dwayne's office with a shredder.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Archer Daniels Midland has become so visibly disgraced in terms of business and corporate ethics. You wouldn't think anyone would want to have too much to do with them, but, you know, money talks. Another interesting thing, and campaign finance is also very bipartisan. To wit, Debbie Dingell, wife of former Congressman John Dingell, mm-hmm. Both Democrats. Debbie's a lobbyist for GM, and she ponied up $100,000 in the service of underwriting these inaugural balls.
That's interesting.
Inaugural. So I suspect that even though she has Democratic ties, she'll definitely get respectful consideration. when she has business before the administration or Republicans on the Hill.
And this is a an interesting thing. You know, last night I ran into a bunch of Indiana Republicans who were in their black tie outfits who were slumming in one of the corner neighborhood bars, and they said that there were as many Democrats at the Indiana ball as there were Republicans.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, that's the true nature of bipartisanship. Everyone's scrumming to the new people in power to make sure that they're noticed, and they remind them that they're there, and everyone's here to do business. It's mutually beneficial and basically enables the continued existence of a democratic, quote-unquote two-party system that really ain't. Some other interesting contributors. Well, let's see. Visa and MBNA, $100,000 each. The credit card companies do everything they can to screw consumers. Luckily, one of their champions, Bill McCollum from the House, was defeated in his bid for the Senate in Florida. But I think it's a safe bet that they're going to do everything they can to make sure that consumers who should be able to reduce credit card debt or come up with manageable plans don't get that. On the lower end, Wackin' Hut.
Another famous company, Wackin' Hut, the security company for Department of Energy facilities for U.S. embassies abroad.
And also with not a great record in terms of things like employee confidentiality. They gave less. They gave about $20,000. But a really interesting name that jumped out on this list was Gene Raper, who is a Sacramento, California political consultant who represents the Agua Caliente Bend of Coahuila Indians, who make quite a bit of money off gaming, and that tribe has made so much money that, in fact, they've spent about $70 million in various initiatives in the state of California to make sure that gaming stays legal. So they donated $100,000 to the inaugural. So I'm sure. And I suspect that Gail Norton, who was Secretary of Interior, has oversight of Bureau of Indian Affairs, that won't be lost on her either. We also see some of the other usual suspects here. Coca-Cola gave, one of their executives or lobbyists gave $100,000. Who else do we have? There's also another a sort of interesting name in Washington history. Only gave $5,000, but interesting that he did. Philip Christensen, who's an ex-Foreign Service officer and veteran Jesse Helms aide, who had a reputation on the Hill as Jesse's hatchet man in sinking the nominations of various ambassadors or diplomats who were considered too liberal or not in line with Helms' view of the world. So he gave $5,000, but it was interesting to see his name pop up here. And then Enron, of course. Ken and Linda Lay, longtime supporters of W, based in Texas, gave $100,000, and so did several other Enron executives.
So those of you who are paying high prices for natural gas this winter know where some of that money's going.
Bingo. So that's that's about. I mean, it's the thing that is just galling again about what you read from the Post is that while these are the inaugural balls and the inaugural weekend is considered a major social event in Washington, what it really is something. It's a boon to whichever party gets elected, because it's another opportunity
to rake in corporate cash
for them to. But it really doesn't do them as much good as it does the people who want to influence them. This is really a good opportunity for them, and the system we have, it's shrewd of them to take advantage of that.